Okay, so this talk will be a little bit different than some of the things you're discussing at this workshop. So I will not be mentioning words like pseudo gap or quantum critical points, but hopefully I will be mentioning something that's of interest to you. Okay, so the title of my talk is Probing the Vortex State with Polarized Muons. And I think arriving at a detailed understanding of the vortex state still poses a great theoretical and experimental challenge. And this is true even in conventional S-wave superconductors. So theoretically, the information needed to describe the vortex state in a conventional superconductor is contained in the microscopic equations. But solving those equations for a multidimensional order parameter and in the regions of the phase diagram that are of interest to us has turned out to be a monumental task. Experimentally, the techniques that we need to investigate the vortex state have taken a long time to develop. So I think the combination of these things means that even today we're learning new things about the vortex state in a conventional superconductor. In the case of unconventional superconductors, I think we're barely even rounding first base in our understanding of the vortex state. Generalizing existing theoretical approaches to the case of non-S-wave symmetry order parameters may not be sufficient to describe the vortex state in these materials. And then experimentally, most of these materials are just difficult to probe. So for instance, in high temperature superconductors, a lot of the investigations of the vortex state have suffered from extrinsic effects such as sample quality and poor sample surface homogeneity. And then the other problem in high temperature superconductors is the large upper critical fields. So experiments have really only been able to probe a very narrow region of the vortex phase diagram. In other unconventional superconductors like heavy fermions, the problems are things to do like such as low superconducting transition temperatures and very long penetration depths, making a lot of the experiments difficult to do. So here I'd like to give you just a historical chart of what I think are some of the key advancements in our understanding of the vortex state as it pertains to my presentation to today. So this list is by no means complete. So of course, in 1957, we had the prediction of the vortex state from Abakosov's solutions of the Ginzburg-Landau equations, and that was the same year as BCS theory was revealed to us. And then in 1965 came the prediction that the vortex cores of conventional S-wave superconductor contained bound quasi-particle states. In 1974 came the prediction that due to the thermal depopulation of these bound core states, the size of the vortices has a temperature dependence to them in a conventional superconductor. However, it wasn't until the advent of STM that in 1989, STM measurements on niobium diselenide experimentally verified that these quasi-particle bound core states exist. In 1993 came the first theoretical treatment of a D-wave vortex relevant to the high-temperature superconductors, and this is the work of Volvik, which produced the famous density of states is proportional to the square root of the magnetic field. In that same year, there was an STM study done on niobium diselenide, which showed that the size of the vortices changed with magnetic field. And also in 1993, small-angle neutron scattering and MUSR measurements experimentally verified for the first time the vortex lattice melting phenomena in high-temperature superconductors. In 1994 came the first microscopic treatment of a D-wave vortex led by Catherine Callan and John Berlinski. And also in that same year came the first experimental evidence for the D-wave nature of the vortex state. And that came by way of specific heat measurements by Catherine Moeller and MUSR measurements of the magnetic penetration depth. And also in 1994, there came a theoretical prediction from the quasi-classical theory that the size of the vortices in an S-wave superconductor changes with magnetic field. It wasn't until 1995 that we had our first STM measurement of a vortex core in high-TC materials, and these were the measurements on YBCO, which produced features in the differential tunneling conductance, which indicated the possibility of low-energy bound core states. In the next 3 years to follow, several groups are credited with arriving at the conclusion that a D-wave vortex cannot contain localized core states, but rather the states are extended out along the nodal directions of the D-wave order parameter. In 1997, USR measurements showed that the size of the vortices in the bulk of niobium diselenide and YBCO, the size of the vortices changes with magnetic field. And then in 1999 came in a very important neutron scattering experiment, which showed that the geometry of the vortex lattice in YBCO is actually hexagonal, confirming suspicions that all the previous neutron measurements on this material, which showed fourfold symmetric lattices, were actually strongly influenced by the presence of twin boundaries. Also in that year came prediction that the size of the vortices in a D-wave superconductor should change with magnetic field. And low energy muon experiment performed at Paul Scherrer Institute in Switzerland, where you can plant muons near the surface of a superconductor, showed that the size of the vortices blow up near the surface of a superconductor. And then in just this past year, I think USRM measurements provided the first real direct experimental proof that there is a Kramer-Pesch effect in a conventional superconductor. So I'm going to talk about some of the USR experiments in particular in my presentation.
What is Kramer-Pesch effect?
It's the temperature dependence of the vortices.
Pore size.
Pore size. Well, of course, muon spin rotation, or muSR, can be used to measure the inhomogeneous field associated with the vortex state. And a muon is good for this because it's a spin-half particle, so it only interacts with its surroundings magnetically. So the way the technique works is one starts with a nearly 100% spin-polarized muon beam, and then you pass the muon through a thin detector, and that starts an electronic clock. And then the muon goes into the sample, comes to rest. And when it comes to rest, its spin Larmor processes around the local magnetic field. And then after a few microseconds, it decays into a positron. You detect the positron, and that stops the electronic clock. And so that event is recorded in a histogram, and after many such counts, one gets a raw time spectrum that looks something like this. So here you see the clear oscillation due to the muon spin precession, and then you see an exponential decay due to the muon lifetime. By combining raw time spectra from opposing sets of positron counters, you can remove the muon lifetime. And what you're left with is what we call the asymmetry spectrum, which just shows the oscillation of the muon spin corresponding to the local field at the muon site. Now, the real advantage muSR has in the high TC materials over conventional NMR or neutron scattering is it can look into the bulk of very small, high-quality crystals. So in the ideal case, the vortices arrange themselves in a periodic array. And when you implant the muons into the sample, because it's a positive particle, it likes to reside at an interstitial site. On the other hand, in the high temperature superconductors, there's good evidence that the muon actually binds to an oxygen atom, hydrogen bonds to it. But the exact location of the muon in the crystal lattice is irrelevant because the muons stop randomly on the large length scale of the vortex lattice. So you can see my little muons coming. So these muons will sample a field distribution of the sample, which for this particular case, the hexagonal arrangement of vortices, will look something like this. So the key features here are that you have a minimum field due to the field at the center of the triangle formed by three adjacent vortices. You have a peak due to the Van Hove singularity from the saddle point between two neighboring vortices. And then you have a long tail and a cutoff due to the muon stopping near the center of the vortex cores. Okay, now of course in the high temperature superconductors, they're highly anisotropic materials. So one tends to think of
the shape of the distribution.
Yeah.
Came about only because of the geometry of the lattice, or
geometry of the lattice. That's right.
So you don't account for the muon to be. The fact that it likes to sit somewhere else and in some particular place.
No, because the size of the crystal lattice is a few angstroms,
yeah, right.
Where a typical vortex lattice is 1,000 angstroms of a few vortices apart. So, okay, so as I was saying, the high TC materials are very anisotropic, so one tends to think of the vortices as being comprised of these pancake vortices or two-dimensional vortices, which at low temperatures will line up to form these nice three-dimensional vortices. And then in other cases, when you have a lot of sample inhomogeneities, you can have entire sheets of pancake vortices being displaced from a sheet of vortices in an adjacent layer due to these pinning effects. And so you get these sort of wobbly vortex lines. And then in other cases where you have extreme thermal fluctuations, you can have complete melting of the vortex lattice. So if you implant muons into this material here, you can imagine if muons stop on all layers of the sample, what you measure instead of the field distribution which I just showed you, you just measure a symmetric field distribution. So here's an example of some vortex lattice melting studies done in high temperature superconductors. Here you have a study done on BISCO and then underdoped YBCO, and you can see that the skewness parameter here quantifies the asymmetry of the line shape. So at low temperatures, This parameter has a value of the order of 1, indicating that you have a very well-ordered vortex lattice. And so your line shape is very asymmetric. And then all of a sudden, as you increase temperature, all of a sudden it drops rapidly to 0 or to a negative value, indicating that the vortex lattice has melted. And the fact that it drops quite rapidly at a given temperature is consistent with other experiments, which have established that the melting transition is first order in nature.
So is the implication here that your nice field line doesn't really look like that, but it looks like some wall?
It just looks like a Gaussian distribution.
And skewness is sort of how it deviates from the Gaussian.
Yeah, if your field distribution is highly asymmetric, as you would expect in a well-ordered lattice.
Yeah.
This is actually an important point, because this will be important near the end of my presentation. Then you expect the skewness parameter of the order of 1. But once it becomes Gaussian, then you can just put in the moments here, and you'll find that your skewness parameter goes to 0. It's actually negative in the BISCO case, because you have what's called the sample geometry effect, where there's sort of an inhomogeneous field near the edges, which gives you a little low field tail. That's how you end up with negative values here.
So what's the most important thing? The saddle points aren't all the same when it's melted, or what's the...
Well, it's just if you could go back to that picture here. You imagine you got up on a ladder, and you look straight down, and you could see all the layers. All you would see is red. Whereas in this case, if you got up on the ladder and you look straight down, you would see red circles in a blue background. So in other words, this just looks like a big homogeneous field to the muons, because you're sampling every layer.
I don't understand that, because the muons are sampling every layer.
Yeah.
They're sitting in one layer.
No, statistically, after you do many, many counts, the muons will have stopped on various layers in the sample. And that would just look like a big homogeneous field.
But then, no, we still see a wall, right? Because the field varies between some low value and some high value, right? I mean,
there is some spread, but it's symmetric.
Yeah, but that's not like a uniform field. A uniform field.
It's more, okay, it looks more uniform than the other.
Yeah.
You're right, it does have some width to it.
Yeah.
So what matters is the instantaneous field, is it? What's that? The time scale that the muon averages the field over, and some melted vortex liquid each vortices would be moving around.
That's right.
The time average field at any given muon is over a long enough time, it would be the same no matter where it sits, I guess.
That's right.
Is that the relevant quantity, or do I actually care about the instantaneous field?
Well, the thing is that we put about 20 million muons into the sample. So even if the vortex lattice moves a little bit, which it will, of course, if it's in the melted phase, it won't, after you average everything, it's not going to time average everything. It's just going to look like symmetric field distribution.
But a single muon will have some time averaging to do, right? I mean, it's the time scale presumably is the precession frequency, and anything that happens much faster than that,
that's right.
It will be average.
Presumably
that's right.
Compared to the vortex motion.
Is it?
If you just have a 3D vortex, for instance, and it's fluctuating, the muon will measure the field averaged over those fluctuations. Is that what you're asking?
Over a slight time.
Yeah, that's right.
Fluctuates
right.
The time scale for small.
That's right, because it fluctuates faster. It's on average of a couple microseconds. But the vortices are
slow.
Yeah. The vortices
it's
are
slow for individual vortex vibrations, but
yeah, that's right.
On the scale of max or volume.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So. Moving along then, one of the points I wanted to make here was that, for instance, in underdoped YBCO, this is the phase diagram that came out of that study. So you have these nice 3D ordered vortex lattice here, and then you have this melted phase. And you can see that in underdoped YBCO, it melts at quite modest fields of the order of 1 tesla. So this means you have to be careful when you interpret experiments which are measured as a function of field, because once the vortex makes the transition into liquid phase, you have something totally different. Okay, so one of the quantities that you can measure with μSR is the magnetic penetration depth. And in the case of the vortex state, it's just the length scale over which the field decays outside of the vortex core. So then I'd like to explain how that actually comes out of the data. So here is actually a muon precession signal in the vortex state of niobium diselenide. And you, first thing you notice is that there's two signals, and that's because these correspond to two different pairs of positron counters, and they just differ by a phase of 90 degrees. The red curve through the data points is actually a fit, assuming a phenomenological distribution or field distribution, which in this case is against Ginzburg-Landau model. You see that the precession signal decays with time, and that's because muons stopping at different places in the vortex lattice precess at a different frequency, and so when you sum all that up, you end up with a signal that relaxes in time. So the rate at which this relaxes in time is related to the penetration depth, which in turn is related to the width of the field distribution in the sample. So you can get an approximate picture of what the field distribution looks like in the sample just by taking a fast Fourier transform of this, and that's what appears below here. So the data here is the solid curve, and you can ignore the shaded region. That's just a background signal. And then the red dotted line here is the fit from the time domain. Now, it's very important to realize this is not the field distribution in the sample. And the reason is that there's problems with doing a finite Fourier transform here. Because the time range is finite, when you do a Fourier transform, you get ringing in the fast Fourier transform. The other problem is because of the muon lifetime, as you go out to later times, there are less and less counts out here. And so when you do a Fourier transform, that puts noise into the Fourier transform. So we try to minimize those distortions by apodizing, but that has the pitfall in that it broadens the sharp features in the field distribution. So you don't clearly see the saddle point, for instance, there's a sharp peak here. Now, the reason that we know that the field distribution of the sample is much sharper is because the field distribution that was actually used to fit the time domain is this thing that's in the inset. You can see that it has very nice sharp features. So the important point is not to be fooled by the broadening or smearing of the sharp features in the Fourier transform, because that's not the true field distribution in the sample.
So you said that sharp thing would fit, but did it have to be that sharp in order to fit?
What's that?
You said you know the field distribution is much sharper because this fit the data.
This is what seems to fit this.
Yeah, but it didn't have to be that sharp in order to fit the data.
Yeah, like what if you used a real point?
If I use this? Yeah. No, you wouldn't be able to fit the data with this. Because you wouldn't. I mean.
Let's ask another question. Is the field distribution that gives you your best fit, is there a parameter which would broaden it?
Yes, okay. There is another parameter, which is actually Gaussian broads this thing a little bit. And it's a very small broadening, nothing of the order of this. And that's included in the analysis because you always have some kind of disorder in the lattice that will broaden these features a bit.
You're saying the Gaussian broadening, which gives the best fit, is the small value that we see. It's very narrow, you're saying.
It's much closer to this, not this. This is broadened due to the apodization. I can remove the apodization and show you that this has much sharper features, except for you'll see a lot of noise and ringing in the data because of this problem.
If it's not the real distribution, I mean, what's this thing is useful for? What should see it looking at
it? It just gives us, first of all, if we're doing an experiment, we'd like to know whether there's even a vortex lattice or we're measuring something else.
Just saying that you have some asymmetric structure, you would say that this is a lattice or something.
Yes. Okay. Now, it maybe sounds all wishy-washy right here, but let me just show you how well it works. Okay, so it's helpful, of course, to know what the geometry of the vortex lattice is when you analyze the USR time spectrum. So as mentioned earlier, neutrons have confirmed that in YBCO, the vortices actually arrange themselves in a hexagonal or triangular fashion. And in fact, there's been a calculation done from the quasi-classical theory, which shows that in a D-wave vortex, or a D-wave superconductor, even though the individual vortices may be four-fold symmetric, at low fields, they like to arrange themselves in a triangular or hexagonal arrangement. And the prediction is that this should occur for fields at less than 15% of the upper critical field, which in YBCO works out to be about 15 tesla. So the actual precession signal in YBCO looks something like this. Again, you can see that it decays very rapidly due to the penetration depth. And the fast Fourier transform looks something like this. Now, you can compare this to something like the fast Fourier transform of the precession signal in strontium ruthenate. This is work by Graham Luke. And you can, in strontium ruthenate, the vortices are known to form a square lattice. And you can see the big difference between this Fourier transform and this one is this hump that you have on the minimum field side. And that's a signature of a square vortex lattice. This second peak here is a background signal, and you can ignore that.
Can you just say what the background means?
The background is just due to muons which miss the sample and then avoid our background suppression system that we have in place. So it's usually sitting right at the applied field.
Why does hump mean square lattice?
If you just work, figure it out, the minimum is separated further from the saddle point in a square lattice than is the case in a triangular lattice. So the minimum is staying further away from the saddle point. It's just a geometry thing.
Sorry, I'm sure you said this before. I didn't quite catch it. The single hump structure, can you distinguish really between a triangular crystal with some quasi-long range order and between a solid crystal with short range hexagonal?
Probably not. Okay, so just to show you how well you can do. So for instance, in this particular example I show you, this is measurements done in YBCO, and we fit assuming this hexagonal lattice before neutrons had ever confirmed that the lattice was hexagonal. And the MuSR measurements were done at 5 kiloersteds in the vortex state, and that's the red dots here. And then you can see that it has excellent agreement with the microwave measurements of Walter Hardy done at zero field, which are these crosses here. Okay, so keep in mind that in the microwave measurement, the penetration depth corresponds to the field coming in at the surface of the superconductor, whereas in the vortex state, we're measuring the field coming out of the vortex core. Now, of course, a lot of interest in what happens at higher field in these materials, mainly due to these thermal conductivity measurements a few years ago that showed these high field plateaus. And were initially interpreted as a possibly field-induced second component in the order parameter. So we decided to look at what happens to the penetration depth at higher fields. And this is what came out of that experiment. So the 5 kiloersted data is this red dots, which I just shown you on the previous slide. And then the data taken at 4 and 6 tesla is these other dots here. And before I talk about the low temperature region, you'll notice that at the high temperature region, you can see these data sets start to deviate from one another, and that's just due to vortex lattice melting effects in this material. And in fact, this agrees quite well with other experiments. Back at the low temperature end, you see that this quantity 1 over lambda squared, which is normally proportional to the superfluid density, saturates. And that's opposite behavior of what you would expect if there was a field-induced second component that opened up a full gap at the Fermi surface. You would expect it to do something like this.
This is lambda AB determined by the field distribution in the vortex state.
That's right.
Fitting that to the London model for the vortex.
Right, but actually the curve that you get out here is actually very robust with respect to the model that you use. The only thing that really changes is the quantitative value. So a different model will give you a different absolute value of the penetration depth, but it does not change the qualitative behavior.
So what exactly do you mean when you say the curves, the data sets deviate from each other? I mean, they seem to...
Well, actually, this is starting to come down well below TC.
There's one data point that's off.
Yeah, but you can look at other experiments, magnetization experiments, and they actually predict that, for instance, at this field, this will start to melt at this temperature. That's what I'm trying to say. You're right, there's not enough data here to clearly see it.
This is all the data that you have of this type? You don't have intermediate field regimes of 2 or...
Oh, we do. I didn't bring it with me.
So if I twisted your arm, could you say whether all of those curves peel off at the same temperature or whether or not they peel off at different temperatures?
No, I think this 4 tesla data is actually sitting slightly above. But the problem is the next lowest field we did was 1.5 tesla. It's actually still got a little bit of slope on it, but it's weaker than that.
I'm making the point that in the intermediate temperature regime, they all seem to follow some
right here
curve,
And then I'm wondering whether or not the curves kind of saturate at different temperatures.
That's what we were hoping to get out of the data, but we couldn't.
Really,
I don't think you can, we can say.
Okay.
I think there's too much scatter to make any statement like that. Okay, so just to show you that this is the field dependence here seen in other materials, this is work also done by Graham Luke in the 214 material. And you can see as you go up in the field, you also start to get the saturation at low temperatures. Of course, they didn't go up in high enough field here to see a complete saturation. So the question is then, what is causing this field dependence of the penetration depth? And of course, one obvious contribution is these nonlinear effects associated with the D-wave superconductor. So here you have the superflow that's induced by the field shifts the energy quasi-particle excitation spectrum, and it shifts it below the Fermi surface, producing this backflow of quasi-particle current. And that weakens the supercurrent response, giving you a field-dependent penetration depth. And in a conventional S-wave superconductor, the nonlinear effects are not so important because you have this full energy gap at the Fermi surface. So that's one possibility. Now, the group of Mohamed Amin, Ian Affleck, and Marcel Franz determined that the nonlinear effects alone were not enough to explain this big saturation with magnetic field. So what they suggested then was the more dominant effect was the non-local effects in a D-wave superconductor. And so the non-local effects arise due to the divergence of the coherence length near the gap nodes. So these quasi-particles then are subjected to non-local electrodynamics. And at the end of the day, what you don't end up with is a reduction or a change in the superfluid density. But what happens is the maximum field at the vortex center is suppressed. And so, in fact, just near the vortex center is suppressed. So that as you start increasing field, these regions that were affected by these non-local effects start to overlap. And it looks like a field-dependent penetration depth in the MuSR experiment. And so, we were able to take our zero temperature values and compare them to their theory. And the MuSR measurements are the red circles, and their theoretical prediction is the blue circles due to these non-local and non-linear effects. And you can see that there's this really good agreement. So we thought that was the end of the story. But of course, whenever you talk about non-linear, non-local effects, you not only have to get the field dependence right, you also have to get the temperature dependence right.
How much fitting goes into this agreement? How much adjustment of parameters do you have to do in the theory to get this?
None. I'm not sure what you're asking.
Well, I guess he's wondering if there were any free parameters in a nonlinear or non-local theory.
Oh, I see. No, not that I know of, but I don't know the details.
And there must be things taken from experiment.
You guys are theorists. So. None that they told me about. What's that?
That's right, as well as probably the sub like V alpha over V delta. I mean,
I think for lambda zero they just assume like a value from the literature or something. But
it's fair to say that the theory paper came first, right? And then
the theory did come first.
So that's okay.
Right. Right. But we had made some these measurements down here actually were made already when they started the theory. These three points we hadn't measured yet. Okay, so we asked them to go back and determine what the temperature dependence of the penetration depth would do in their theory. And because we had lots of data as a function of temperature. And you can see here that what happens is that they get really nice agreement with our high field data, but you can see that there's a strong deviation from their theory with our low field data. And this is really surprising because it's the low field data that agrees so nicely with the microwave measurements. So we're left here to conclude that either their theory somehow breaks down at low fields, or their theory is just not correct for explaining the field dependence that we're measuring. So this is an open question. The other puzzling thing is that if you compare the field dependence measured in high TC material to, for instance, niobium diselenide, and these are compared at 1/3 of TC, so the field dependences are weaker here. But you can see that indeed there is a stronger field dependence in the high TC material, but there is still a sizable field dependence in conventional superconductor. And this is probably larger than one would expect just from nonlinear effects in an S-wave superconductor. So this is another open question which we have not been able to answer.
I'm sorry, Jeff, can you go back one second? So, one forward now. There we go. The slope for YBCO, does that fit Yip-Sol's?
Yip-Sol's is from the Meissner state, right?
I'm sorry, does it fit, I guess, does it fit Amin at all?
Well, you can see,
that you showed us before.
Well, you can see here,
forget it.
Yeah, there's going to be some problems as you get to the lower fields. Okay. Okay, so now I'd like to just move and talk about the other parameter you can measure with mu SR. And in what follows, I'm going, which is the vortex core size. And in what follows, I'm going to introduce several so-called coherence lengths. So it's important that you keep separating in your mind the definitions of these coherence lengths. So what I've drawn here, of course, is the order parameter as you come into the center of a vortex core in a conventional superconductor, where the order parameter is strongly suppressed. And the coherence length refers to the length scale for spatial variations of this order parameter. So this is the Ginzburg-Landau coherence length. The other thing that's drawn here, this blue curve, is the supercurrent density, the spatial dependence of the supercurrent density as you come out from the center of a vortex core. And, of course, it has the very pronounced feature, which is this peak. And I'm going to call the distance from the center of the vortex core to this peak R0, which I'm also going to call the size of the vortex cores. Okay. Now, how does this supercurrent density profile come out of the mu-SR data? Well, the way it comes out is that one fits the mu-SR time spectra, assuming some field profile, and then you take the curl of that, and that gives you the supercurrent density profile. Now, the really crucial point here is that once you take the curl of this, it doesn't really matter if this has any physical significance. All it requires is that you could fit your data really well. And in fact, we verified that this is pretty much model independent.
Excuse me, I'm ignorant about this, but in usual S-wave superconductors, what's the difference between Xi and R0, percentage-wise?
Well, for these were actually plots using the microscopic equations, and you can see that
for a single vortex, right?
For a single vortex, that's right.
So what's the difference?
I'm going to show you a couple examples of differences, and you're going to find that it's a very model-dependent difference between this
parameter. What you've actually shown here is just simple S wave.
That's right. Yeah. Okay. And they're fairly close, but they're not exact. They're closer at high fields, and they deviate more from each other at low fields. Okay, so here's just some examples of some fits field profiles that we got out of some niobium diselenide data. I don't want to explain this data right now, but this is just the B of R, and then you take the curl of it, and you get the supercurrent density profile, and you can see that the maximum here shifts, which tells us the size of the vortices is changing. Okay, now theoretically, it's customary to describe the spatial dependence of the order parameter within a vortex by this expression. Perhaps some of you even use this. Delta naught is the size of the energy gap, and psi is the Ginzburg-Landau coherence length, which I referred to. And the problem is that at very low temperatures, for instance, the solutions of the microscopic equations deviate tremendously from this expression. And they deviate mainly near the center of the vortex axis, of the vortex core. So this is the center of the core moving radially outwards. And so to quantify changes of the slope here near the vortex center, people have introduced this other length scale, which is called psi 1. And they define this area governed by psi 1 as the vortex core. It turns out that psi 1 is very close to where the supercurrent density peaks. And so when I show plots of psi 1 in R0, you're almost looking at the same thing, but not exactly. The other thing that you'll notice, and this is an important point, is that this order parameter rises up to its bulk value over the distance of psi naught, and psi naught is the BCS coherence length. So this means that when I say that the size of the vortices is changing, what I'm not saying is that the spatial extent of the Cooper pairs way out here in the superconducting medium is changing. That's an important point.
Sorry, when you say microscopic theory, you mean some solutions, some equations.
Yeah, these are actually solutions of the Eilenberger equations, which are quasi-classical.
So everything is going to be very dependent on the interaction shape at some moment, at time moment, right? Or I guess what I'm trying to say is that this picture will be modified depending, very strongly depending on what I'm
going to put into that equation, right?
Right, and in particular, things like temperature and field and things of that nature. Okay, so as mentioned, the vortex cores in a conventional S-wave superconductor contain bound core states. And as you thermally depopulate these states, what happens is the size of the vortices changes. And theoretically, it's only these bound states which contribute via the self-consistency equations to the spatial dependence of the order parameter and the supercurrent density profile. So when you change the population of these levels, you end up changing the size of the vortices. So a recent calculation, and this is actually an extension of work that was done by Kramer and Pesch back in 74, but this is work done by a Japanese group in the Bogui-Wafdegen formalism. And you can see that this parameter psi 1, which defines the size of the vortex cores, decreases with decreasing temperature and then saturates in the quantum limit where only the lowest bound energy level is occupied. And you can see that for larger vortices, or for larger vortex core sizes, the quantum limit is reached at a much lower temperature. So here are the results of some USR measurements in niobium diselenide. And the core size, again, defined from the peak in the supercurrent density profile. And you can see that, indeed, the vortex core size decreases with temperature and then saturates at some low temperature. So I think this is the first direct measurement of the Kramer-Pesch effect in a conventional superconductor. The inset shows the theoretical prediction for this particular material using some values of the coherence length and stuff taken from other experiments. And you can see that you have good qualitative agreement. Although there is quantitatively, this comes down a lot steeper than this does, although it doesn't look like it the way I plotted it. And we're not quite sure why, but we think one of the possibilities is that the calculation was actually only done for a single isolated vortex. And as I'm going to show you in a minute, I think vortex interactions have a lot to do with what goes on in these materials.
So the scale of M angstroms where the inset saturates?
Roughly 10 angstroms. So see, quantitatively, we're way off.
Okay,
but again, that's only a single vortex calculation. And we do know that the slope changes with field.
But there's a number, which is the BCS coherence length, psi naught, which is the same for both of them. I mean, allegedly, in the sense that they take psi naught from some experiment that you believe.
Well, we don't pull psi naught out of our own data. They assumed a value in their calculation, and that came from some other experiment.
But is it? I mean,
what is?
Yeah, where? What other experiment does it come from? And could psi naught from the other
experiment I think they estimated from a tunneling experiment or something. I'm not sure. I mean, just from the gap. The energy size of the energy gap. I think they estimated it. But you can see that it makes a big difference. What size of the coherence length you choose, because this thing will look different. So that's one possibility.
But just wait, so that inset, they were trying to model niobium?
They're trying to predict what we should see.
For that particular material.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so here's just to show you that we've measured this effect in other materials. So this is the borocarbide superconductor, lithium nickel borocarbide. And you can see here on the right, the core size does decrease with temperature, although in this particular study, they didn't go to low enough temperatures to see it actually saturate. I should say something about the analysis of this data. Lithium nickel borocarbide is a tetragonal superconductor. And when you apply the field along the C-axis, at low temperatures, there's a vortex lattice transition at around 1 Tesla from a hexagonal arrangement of vortices to a square vortex lattice. And the way the square lattice has been explained in this material is using a non-local model, London model, developed by Kogan. And it seems to explain neutron and STM measurements quite well. And it turns out that it ends up fitting the USR spectrum very nicely as well. Okay, what about the high-temperature superconductors? Okay, well, here I've plotted some data for the high TC materials, optimally doped and underdoped YBCO, along with the results from niobium diselenide and lithium nickel borocarbide. And they're normalized here with respect to the same to their value of TC. So the first thing you know is that the niobium diselenide and the borocarbide superconductor fall on the same line here. And those both show a strong Kramer-Pesch effect. In the high TC materials, you see that there's not much temperature dependence here at all. And there are probably two possible reasons for that. The first you could say is, first thing you could say is if there are some bound states in the vortices of these materials, then because the size of the vortices are so small, the quantum limit might be reached at a very high temperature. So you never actually see much change in the size of the vortices with temperature. The other possibility is this, if these really are D-wave vortices in these materials, then you don't see a Kramer-Pesch effect due to these, the fact that you have these extended quasi-particle states. In either case, the small amount of temperature dependence that you do see can be due just to thermal fluctuations, because as mentioned, the muon will detect the field averaged over the fluctuation, and those fluctuations will increase as you go up in temperature. So you can see that there's a remarkable difference between what you see in a high-temperature superconductor and what you see in a conventional superconductor.
Now you've normalized these, but does the core size or not change with doping? Like, or is the underdoped very different?
I'm going to show you actually some data as function of field where you can actually compare
where the two. Where it's absolute value.
Yeah. Okay, so now I want to turn to the other thing, which is the field dependence of the core size. Okay, so again, we're just getting the core size from this peak in this supercurrent density profile, which is fairly robust with respect to the model that we use for the field distribution. And so you can see here some measurements that we did in niobium diselenide at a particular temperature. And you can see that the core size decreases with temperature and eventually saturates. And so you can think of this as a mechanism of saving condensation energy, this shrinking of the vortex core size, as you put more and more vortices into the sample. Above this, you see that this is showing STM measurements done on the surface of the same kind of material, and they too see a decrease in the vortex core size. But you'll notice, first of all, that there's a big difference in the absolute value of the core size that they get from the STM measurement. And there's two reasons for that. One is that they define the core size differently, where we define it as the distance to the peak in the supercurrent density profile. They just call it the width of the tunneling profile going across the vortex, which is just a Gaussian shape thing. The other reason is because, as mentioned, the vortices actually blow up at the surface of the superconductor, and so they measure larger vortex core size. There are error bars are also considerably larger because they determine this core size by sampling a few vortices at the surface, whereas in the muSR experiment, the muons are sampling tens of thousands of vortices in the bulk. Here are the measurements that we did on lithium nickel borocarbide, and again, you see a field dependence. Now here I've actually plotted both the core size and the coherence length that's included in the model. And you can see here that there's a big difference between these two quantities, which is not the case in the niobium diselenide. And this is something that has to do with Kogan's non-local model. But the interesting thing is that the coherence length saturates at a value out here that if you calculate the upper critical field, you get a value of 65 kiloorsteds, which is what you get from other kinds of experiments that have determined HC2 in this material. Okay, so the question then is, if the change in the vortex core size that we're measuring with muSR is really intrinsic, then it should show up in other experiments, because a change in core size in the conventional superconductor will lead to a change in the density of bound core states. And one of the experiments which I think it's playing a role in is in measurements of electronic-specific heat. So in an S-wave superconductor, one expects the contribution of the core states to the specific heat to vary as a linear function of H because the density of vortices is just proportional to the applied field. On the other hand, in D-wave superconductor, as you all know, the specific heat should vary as the square root of H due to these extended states. So here's some examples of some specific heat measurements in conventional materials, niobium diselenide and vanadium 3 silicon, and you can see that they do not vary linearly as a function of field, but there's significant curvature in these materials. And in fact, you can find examples in all the major classes of superconductors, borocarbides, heavy fermions, even organic superconductors, where the specific heat shows significant curvature down at low fields. The other thing that we know is that, for instance, in niobium diselenide, if you start alloying this thing with tantalum, eventually you can put in enough tantalum that you'll make this curve look linear. And there's also been alloying studies done in the borocarbides now, which also can create this linear field dependence just by putting in impurities. The question is, what I think is causing the field dependence is the following. Here's an expression for the specific heat in the conventional S-wave superconductor. And this last term is the contribution of the vortices to the specific heat. And it's derived from the Bogoliubov-Degen equations. And you can see in this term, there's the magnetic induction, which must have some field dependence to it. And so if you just measure the magnetic induction from a susceptibility measurement, and you try to fit the specific heat data, you get this red line here, which you can see does not account for the full curvature in the data. However, also in this expression is the Ginsburg-Landau coherence length, which we know from the MUSR measurements is changing due to the change in the core size. And if you substitute in the field dependence of psi that you get from the MUSR measurements, then you get this red curve, which fits the specific heat data very nicely. Now, it's important to realize that this is not only a qualitative agreement, it's actually quantitative. So we've actually measured at more than one temperature. And at a higher temperature, this thing doesn't show quite so much curvature. And the MUSR measurements don't show so much change in the core size with magnetic field. And it also fits the data quite nicely. Now, if you just ignore the MUSR measurements completely and just look at the specific heat data alone, you can just fit it to a power law expression for the vortex core contribution. And for the two temperatures that we considered, you can extrapolate the exponent that you get to zero temperature, and you get a value of 0.66. A recent calculation using the quasi-classical theory for an S-wave vortex, predicting what the specific heat term should be at zero temperature, gives a value of 0.67. You can see that this is very different than the linear age dependence, and there seems to be pretty good agreement just with the specific heat data by itself. And in that same paper, they also show that this arises due to this reduction in the core size with increasing magnetic field. The other thing that comes out of that paper is they also predict that the specific heat term due to the vortices should vary as h to the 0.41 instead of h to the 1/2. And of course, experiments have not been accurate enough to distinguish those two powers. So what about the high temperature superconductors? Okay. Well, here are, again, plots of optimally and underdoped YBCO as a function of magnetic field. In response to Catherine's question, you can see that there's not much difference between the optimally and underdoped materials here in the size of the vortices. And you can see in this particular model that we used, which was just the hexagonal arrangement of vortices using an analytical Ginsburg-Landau model, the coherence length is very close to the vortex core size. And it saturates out here at a value of 18.5 angstroms, which gives you an upper critical field value of 96 tesla, which is very close to what other experiments estimate the upper critical field to be. Okay, so you can normalize the data and plot all three materials, niobium disilanide, the borocarbonate material, and the optimally doped YBCO material in the same plot. And you can see that the vortex core size changes much more rapidly in YBCO than it does in the other two materials. And this qualitatively agrees with calculations coming out of another paper done by this group, which shows that the vortex core size changes a little bit more rapidly in a D-wave superconductor. Unfortunately, their calculations were done at half a TC, which makes it impossible for us to make a quantitative comparison. So what about other possible explanations of what we measure with MUSR as far as the field dependence of the core size? Well, there's two possibilities. One is that we could be measuring a longitudinal wandering of the vortex lines because these are anisotropic materials. Or alternatively, we could be measuring vortex fluctuations of some kind. So let me first address the first possibility. I think there are a number of things that rule this out. First of all, the STM measurement, which measures the change in the size of the vortices, would not be affected by this wandering of vortex lines. So that's one thing that sort of counters that possibility. The other thing is, if you look at the data for the underdoped and optimally doped material, even though the underdoped material is significantly more anisotropic than the optimally doped material, the core size doesn't change any more rapidly with field. So that's sort of another a point to make. And then the third thing is if you calculate the skewness parameter, which remember is the measure of the asymmetry of the line shape and a measure of the order of the lattice in the material, you find in all these measurements, you get skewness parameters up of the order of 1, which actually turn out to be above the theoretical calculation prediction, which was done at, again, not the same temperature, but you can see that it's up near 1. And so this suggests that 1 does not have these big wandering vortex lines, or that would produce a skewness parameter that's very low. Okay. And then finally, the idea of vortex fluctuations. Again, I think this plot of the skewness parameter sort of counters that suggestion. But I think also if there's vortex fluctuations, then the specific heat measure, that would not affect the specific heat measurements, because that would not change the density of states. So let me just conclude by saying that about 3/4 of what I said is in a review article here, and you're welcome to take a copy freely.
Any other questions?
Maybe I should have asked this question earlier. You mentioned about this effect in which the core size changes because of quasi-quartic occupation self-consistently.
Yeah.
How does it compare with the conventional change of coherence length in Ginzburg-Landau theory?
Well,
this is not put.
Well, this change that's calculated for this effect is calculated at low temperatures. So it's well out of the range of Ginzburg-Landau theory.
I have zero intuition for this Kramer pressure effect. I mean, it sounds as though it kind of just comes out of the solution of the low delta
right.
equations or whatever you like. So if I were to want to understand just the one question of why the ratio of these two lengths is much closer to 1 in the D wave case than in the S wave case. Do you have some intuition? You said some things about because I have quasi-particle wave functions which decay rapidly, then maybe this is the difference. But I don't really understand how that enters.
Just in the temperature dependence? You're wondering why?
The two lengths seem to be much closer, and I thought you made a remark about that.
You mean this spot here? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, right.
Okay, the one is just is normalized, right?
So there are no bound states. But is
right.
it your impression that the bound states are essential in the Kramer Peschel?
For a conventional stapling vector, they are, yeah.
Yeah, and so if I do anything which affects the spectrum of bound states, I'm going to be drastically changing this.
The size of the vortices.
Which
that's right.
The size of the vortices. Okay.
So I think the question that's still up in the air is, are the vortices in the high TC materials really as those that are being predicted theoretically for a D-wave superconductor, or do they differ in some manner? Possibly you have some bound states for some other reason.
Maybe it's too late to ask this also, but presumably the tunneling data looks very different in the YBCO and the BISCO.
Which BISCO data are you talking about?
sorry, I'm thinking of Orsten Fisher and...
Right, and then, of course, their data, not all of their data looks the same as... Seamus Davis' data, which picked up features which they didn't see in theirs. But if you're talking about the underdoped material...
I guess what I'm wondering is, is there a reason we don't see any BISCO data?
Here.
Yeah.
Well, the problem with BISCO is highly anisotropic. And so you don't have to go very high in field before you start melting the lattice and disordering it. And so, It's better to go to higher field where the vortices strongly interact to investigate many of these things. You just can't get to high enough temperatures in BISCO.
I was thinking it might be interesting between the two because at least the early experiments suggested some of them had bound states in, I guess, YBCO, but not the BISCO, and so one might wonder.
Yeah, there was possibly in YBCO, there was none in BISCO, and now the latest claim there is in BISCO. So, but what we would like to see is people go to low field and do an STM measurement. All their measurements are up to 5 or 6 Tesla. And so, in fact, I should probably mention that in this particular plot, if you just take those two features that you see in the STM measurement for YBCO, you assume that's the lowest bound energy level, you can calculate the coherence length from that. And it turns, their measurement was done here at 60 kilocorsets, and it falls right on top of this data, which is interesting, but it might not mean anything.
Although I thought you said the vortices at the surfaces tend to be larger.
That's what's John Kirtley did some calculations on. That's what the low energy muon show.
What?
That's what the low energy muon experiment shows.
Right. So you might expect the result to lie above that curve.
That's right. Okay. But how much? I mean, within experimental area, I don't know.
Why did I think there was a puzzle you guys had for some way of puzzling?
You have lots of puzzles.
Well, I thought the puzzle was the coherence length was, I forget, 10 times that in some of the measurements. Am I just misremembering?
But the coherence length, if you have low fields. But remember, this is not the BCS coherence length.
Yeah. So the vortex,
which I think we were even confused in some of our earlier studies, thinking that that's how it should be interpreted, but it's not.
And it's a factor of 10 different.
Yes. BCS. Yeah. Yeah. I think this is more what the BCS coherence length is out here.
Is there any microscopic reason for such a large change between the two coherence lengths? What
I'm not sure the details of the question you're asking.
No, I'm wondering, I mean, more than a factor of 10.
Well, as you've seen in the boron carbide data, for instance, that's probably not a good example. I mean, I don't know if you can compare the two length scales directly because they mean two different things, right?
No, but he's just talking about the factor of 10 in, you know, R naught. So, you know, I mean, isn't that right?
Right, yeah.
He's saying, you know, just this graph shows, you know, that it started out over 100 and it went down to 20.
Right.
And you're saying in the S wave, you know, that's interpreted as effects of bound states in the core and how they're changing.
Actually, for the field dependence, it's not very clear how this comes out of the microscopic theory. I've asked the Japanese group this several times.
So they just says
it just comes out of the microscopic equations.
They're solving Goguryeo with Degen for the whole lattice.
That's right. They include it. What they say it is, it's a vortex lattice effect due to the transfer of quasiparticles between vortices. And in the D-wave superconductor, because you have these really extended states, then there's a conduit for this quasiparticle just to hop from vortex to vortex. And so that's sort of the physical explanation that comes out of their paper. But I'm not sure how that works exactly in the theory.
Can I get you to speculate a little bit? What do you think the tunnel people will see if they go to really low fields? We have a really weird situation in that the curve distribution is huge, but the pair radius is still whatever it's supposed to be, 15 angstroms
right.
or something. So are they going to be sensitive to the current distribution at all? I mean, I guess there will be Doppler shifts
right.
around the outside. Which
yeah, I don't know.
You don't have any guesses.
Well, if you ignore just the coherence, the BCS coherence length, for instance, and you go down to low temperature, what you'd expect to see is all kinds of bound states in the vortices, if there's really any bound states at all. But this, I mean, I don't know. I think it's just where in our data where we see the most change, and that I think is the interesting part of the to look at.
What are the available techniques for measuring the coherence length? I mean, so you've given us one.
You're looking at it.
Is that it?
This is the only one you can measure in the bulk. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the problem of selling this is because we don't have any techniques to compare to.
Is that right?
It's part of the problem.
There's nothing that would measure an intrinsically zero field penetration. We define.
Well, you can get it from microwave measurements.
Sorry, coherence.
Oh, coherence. No, you have to, I guess, estimate it from some other experiment, assuming some relationship between the coherence length and whatever was measured. But keep in mind, this is in complete agreement with even those estimates that do come from the other experiments. So I think we're probably not wrong in what we think the coherence length is in these materials.
You get good agreement with HC2s in the materials where you can measure HC2, right?
Yes. Right.
One short question. Experimentally, what is the estimate on the number of home states for the case of SVL superconductor? Is there any?
At which temperature?
Very good.
There was actually a... It depends on the size of the vortices. This was actually a plot of the energy levels in the vortex core for different sizes of vortices at zero temperature. So for a coherence length of 60, well, okay, there's another parameter in here, which is the...
So these are theoretical parameters.
Yeah, that's right.
And it fits experiments.
Yeah, but it can go, in iobenisomni, it's believed to be very close to a continuum because you can't actually separate out energy levels. So there's a lot of them. You just see a big broad feature at zero bias in the STM measure, mm-hmm. but you don't see individual spikes.
Thank you, John.